Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on intermediate species when we come back. Well, Charles Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology. He published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe in Lyell's theories and beliefs don't even know who it was that originated those ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. Catastrophes like Noah's flood or Mount St. Helens are strictly ruled out. This is called science. Well, listen to this. Niagara Falls. This famous waterfall is a magnificent example of a geologic clock that reveals that the Earth is very young. Because the rim of the falls is wearing back at a known rate every year. Geologists recognize that it has taken less than 5,000 years to erode from its original precipice to where we see it today. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs and the extinction of the dinosaurs? Do you remember? They told us that was 65 million years ago. Well, now, when we look at Niagara Falls and we listen to 65 million years ago for dinosaurs, and we can make the mathematical calculation today, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on that kind of pseudo-scientific lie. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner of science. And it's one of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here at Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, and it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Probably the biggest, if not the biggest, obstacle to evolutionary philosophy are the intermediate species. Intermediate species. That's a giraffe whose neck is about half as long as giraffes are today. What we need is a series of giraffes that you can look at and identify. And then you've got one with a normal neck, about like a horse, and then you got one that's got a little longer neck and a little longer and longer until you finally get up to the 20-foot species, you know, that you're looking at today. Now, that would be some evidence. Here's an animal that has a short neck, and it's a giraffe, and it's got all of the features of a giraffe, except it's got a short neck. And then as it goes on up the line over here, we come up with a little better giraffe, something that's more like today. But what we actually see when we look into the ancient records, and we look into the fossil record like we did last time, and we find giraffes that are just exactly the same as they are today. And yet, they take a look at that and they say, well, this giraffe came out of this strata, and so this giraffe is 3 million years old, or 5 million years old, or You know, they put long, long ages on here, millions and millions of years ago. And it isn't just with giraffes, it's with horses and giraffes and chipmunks and cockroaches. I mean, anything that you look at is perfectly developed millions of years ago, look just exactly like they do today. And yet, evolution tells us, and this is the theory behind this evolutionary concept over here, is that these species or these kinds of animals change from one to another. In spite of the chromosomes, in spite of the fossil record, in spite of the evidence that we see, we have this belief. It's a philosophy. It's a religion. I asked the question. I said, what's the greatest hoax ever perpetrated upon humankind? Was it the Federal Reserve paper money scam? Was it religion or paper money or global warming or evolution or 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or Remember the Maine or Columbus discovered America first? No, I think evolution is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated. I mean, if you can believe in evolution, you can believe that Santa Claus fits into a 6-inch pipe coming down a hot chimney into a raging fire in an oil furnace to deliver presents on December 25th. Now, these continued sudden appearances have very little change. Let me give you an illustration. In the layers above the Cambrian outburst, Cambrian is way down at the bottom. The testimony of the fossil record is repeatedly the same. New kinds of animals and new kinds of plants appear suddenly, with no connection to anything that went on before them. And that, by the way, fits in with Genesis 1. A full-blown creation created by somebody who we call God. I mean, you can call him Yahweh or you can call him Buddha or Allah. Or, you know, hang a label on this guy. But whoever it is, whoever this fella is, he did it suddenly. It came up right away. It did not come up over a long period of time. There are no intermediate species. These new kinds of animals and new kinds of plants appear suddenly with no connection to anything that went before them. And once on the scene, they continue with very little change. The new evolutionary timetable states, the record now reveals, that species typically survive for 100,000 generations or even a million or more without evolving very much. After their origins, most species undergo very little evolution before becoming extinct. For example, insects appeared in the fossil record suddenly and plentifully without any evolutionary ancestors. Nor have they changed very much, even down to this day. Regarding the finding of a fossil fly that was labeled 40 million years old, Dr. George Poinier said, "The internal anatomy of these creatures is remarkably similar to what you find in flies today. The wings and legs and head and even the cells inside are very modern looking." And a report in the Globe and Mail of Toronto commented, "In 40 million years of struggling up the evolutionary ladder, they have made almost no discernible progress." A similar picture exists for plants. Found in the rocks are fossil leaves of many trees and shrubs. They show very little difference from the leaves of such plants that we see today. Oak, walnut, hickory, grape, magnolia, palm, and many others. Animal kinds follow the same pattern. The ancestors of those alive today appear in the fossil record suddenly and were much like their living counterparts today. There are many variations, but all are easily identified as the same kind. Dogs are dogs are dogs. You know, we see Great Dane dogs and we see Chihuahua dogs, but those are dogs. They're not hamsters, rats. They're not birds. They're not, you know, you can look at a dog and you can say, hey, that's a dog. You can look at a cat and you can say, that's a cat. You got little house cats and you got great big tigers and lions, but they're all cats. And here's another important thing to keep in mind. The Bible tells us that kind reproduces after kind. So, modern man comes along and he comes up with what we call species. So they say, well, look, we take a look at this little Chihuahua dog here. And then we take a look at a Cocker Spaniel. Then we take a look at a German Shepherd. And then we take a look at a Great Dane and a St. Bernard. And then we come to a conclusion. Well, it's pretty obvious. The Chihuahua evolved into this, into this, into this, into this, and so on up the line. And you know, I wouldn't even argue with that. That could well be true. I don't know if Great Danes come out of Chihuahuas or whether Chihuahuas come out of Great Danes. The biblical record tells us that when Noah got on the boat, he took animals in there by clean and unclean. So you take a look at Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, and you find that dogs are unclean. So when he took the clean animals in, he took them in by sevens. That is 14. That's seven pairs. That's 14 total. And when he took the unclean animals in, he took them in pairs. That is two. So we had two cats. We had two dogs. We had, you know, a male and a female of each one. Today, I saw some numbers the other day, and I saw a little contradiction here, so I'm going to give you both. I took a look at one source, and it said there are 476 varieties of dogs. I heard a guy the other day talking on evolution, and he said there were over 700 varieties of dogs. I don't know how many varieties of dogs there are, but I know that there's a bunch. I mean, I personally know of 10 or 15 different varieties of dogs just from my neighbors around me over here. We got a dog here. It's called a Pyrenees dog, big white dog. And when we take a look at these dogs over here, the thing that we find scientifically is that dogs all have the same number of chromosomes. And that's what prevents one kind from interbreeding with another kind. Cats do not interbreed with dogs. Horses do not interbreed with cows. Now, you can take a cow and you can breed it to a buffalo, and we call those beefaloes. But those are the cattle kind, and if you take a look at that cattle kind, they have the same number of chromosomes. And when you come to a kind that has a different kind of chromosome, then you can't jump that barrier. Now, somebody's going to come along and say, hey, wait a minute, in the laboratory, we have created tomatoes when we have spliced in genes from fish. Boys and girls, the controversy here over evolution and special creation is the creationist says there was an intelligence. There was somebody smarter than a pair of dice that are just flipping up by random chance certain numbers. Evolution says, oh no, it's all by random chance. When a scientist goes into a laboratory and gene splices a fish into a tomato, that is intelligence creating that new form of life. Which is exactly my point, that life comes from intelligence. It comes from design. It comes from somebody that has a superior mind to the tomato and the fish, and created one out of the two. No, sir. I deny. I find it hard for anybody with a rational mind, an honest mind, to come up and say that tomatoes and fish, just by random chance, genes spliced themselves together over millions of years of time. Hell, this isn't millions of years. This gene splicing in GMOs, genetically modified organisms, has been going on for less than 50 years. Less than 50 years. And it's an intelligence. It's a design. And this is what God told us back in Genesis chapter 11. He said after the Tower of Babel, he came down and took a look at it. He said, when he saw the Tower of Babel, he said, nothing will be restrained from these fools from this point on. Human beings are very smart people, very smart creatures. We're very innovative. We make 747s fly through the air. You know, that's 500,000-600,000 pounds. You know, you're talking about many, many tons, hundreds of tons of steel and metal and seats and people flying through the air. Now, that's technology. That's intelligence. That's design. 747s, you know, just don't, by random chance, put themselves together, and neither do giraffes. That's the bottom line. Now, when we take a look at the fact that there's no transitional features, you know, another difficulty for evolution here is the fact that nowhere in the fossil record are found partially formed bones or organs that could be taken for the beginning of some new creature, some new feature in a creature. For example, there are fossils of various types of flying creatures. We call them birds, bats, or extinct pterodactyls. Now, according to evolutionary theory, they must have evolved from transitional ancestors. That, you know, you go back in the fossil record and you got this pterodactyl. Well, this pterodactyl, you know, doesn't have feathers, and he flies around like a bat. Bats fly, and they don't have feathers. And so, did it ever occur to us that there's a similarity of design? Just, you know, think about it for a minute. You know, when we make automobiles, did you ever notice that automobiles are made with two headlights, but railroad locomotives are made with one? I don't know why it is that railroad locomotives, back in the old days, you know, the old steam engines, had one great big light right in the center of the boiler. But when we started making automobiles, we put one on each side of it. There's two of them. And then, if you take a look here at automobiles, almost all automobiles have a grill. They have a hood. Now, it's true, sometimes we put the motor in the back, like the Corvair or the Volkswagen, and sometimes we put the motors in the front. I mean, you know, you can put the motor either in the front or in the back. You can have rear-wheel drive or you can have front-wheel drive. But did you notice all these cars have four wheels? I know there was a couple of them came out with three, and we have motorcycles. But, you know, we call motorcycles cycles, and then we call automobiles automobiles. Did you notice the similarity, though, of the design? Almost all automobiles are very similar. Hey, take a look at it. They've all got tail lights. They've all got stop lights. They've all got headlights. They got windshield wipers. They got starters. They got pistons running up and down, you know, crankshafts and gearboxes and things like that. They're very predictable. I've never seen anybody say that a Ford evolved out of a Chevrolet or a Chevrolet evolved out of a Cadillac or a Volkswagen evolved out. You know, if I came to you and I said, well, look at this. Here's this little Volkswagen and here's this big Peterbilt truck. And then I put in some intermediate species over here. So, and I say, this big Peterbilt truck over here evolved out of this little Volkswagen. And here are all the intermediate species, Chevrolets, Cadillacs, two-ton trucks, five-ton trucks, and now look at this big truck. I mean, you'd look at me and you'd say, you know, you got to have your head screwed on backwards, Gordon. Now, when we look at biological living organisms, which are 10 times more complex than an automobile, 10 times, 100 times, they even say, you know, when they take a look at a cell is a very complex little piece of machinery there. It may be tiny, but it's not simple. And they used to tell us these are simple. Then they got to looking at them, and I said, well, now that we got microscopes to look at them, now that we've got electron microscopes, these things are a lot more complex than we originally thought. And the problem that we have here is that there's no transitional features. You know, the New Scientist noted that evolution predicts that a complete fossil record would consist of lineages of organisms showing gradual change continuously over long periods of time. But it admitted, unfortunately, the fossil record does not meet this expectation, for individual species of fossils are rarely connected to one another by known intermediate forms. Known fossil species do indeed appear. They appear not to evolve even over millions of years. And geneticist Stebbins writes, no transitional forms are known between any of the major phyla of animals or plants. And he speaks of the large gaps which exist between many major categories of organisms. In fact, the new evolutionary timetable acknowledges the fossil record does not convincingly document a single transition from one species to another. And now I want to underline this word species over here, because a species is something in the same phyla or kind. Kind reproduces after kind. Dogs reproduce after dogs. Cats reproduce after cats. Horses reproduce after horses. Boys and girls, they got little horses that they've bred down now. Oh, I think they're about, you know, a foot tall, 15, 16 inches tall. I mean, they're just little things that look about like a cocker spaniel. They're not very big at all. And then we've got horses that weigh 3,000 pounds. You know, we call them Percherons and Clydesdales. These horses are all horses. I imagine, you know, except for the mechanics of it, I imagine a big Percheron stallion could breed one of these little 16-inch mares over here, or by artificial insemination. I don't know what's going to come out. But the chromosomes are the same number, and so in theory they can interbreed. I imagine a Great Dane could interbreed with a Chihuahua. You know, there's a mechanical problem there that I can see, but other than that, they're both the same type. So some of them are big and some of them are small. But, you know, you don't mistake a Chihuahua for a horse or a rabbit or a hamster, do you? You know, you can just look at one and you can say, well, that's a dog. You know, you can listen to one of them yapping, you know, and barking, and you can say, well, that's not a whinny that comes out of a horse. Now, I know that somebody's going to breed a donkey to a horse and come up with a mule, but, you know, then when you do that, you come up with a sterile offspring. Same thing with hybridization. There are limits, and that's my point. These limits are built in at the creation, and the Creator himself put those limits on there. The code is in the DNA, and the limits are in the chromosomes. That's the bottom line. And that's what the Bible tells us, and that's what we see in the laboratory. Now, science is something that you can hear it, you can taste it, you can touch it, you can smell it, and you can feel it. You can do it over and over again. You can take it into the laboratory and you can duplicate the experiment. You can do the experiment in New York, and then you can duplicate it in Paris, Moscow, and South Africa. You know, you can do it anywhere. That's science. That's knowledge. You know, that's something you can take to the bank. This evolutionary philosophy over here is a religion. Now, I'm not opposed to religion. You know, people are entitled to believe what they want to believe. And religion is a belief system. And I'm not here to defend religion and the Bible. I don't think that the Bible and religion go together any more than a horse, you know, goes with a dog collar. They're just about that far apart. But evolution doesn't fill in the gap either. That's the bottom line. Now, whether you believe in Buddha or Allah or evolution, or you're an atheist or whatever, you know, your badge or your political stripe, you know, you're certainly entitled to your beliefs over here. But I'm constantly amazed by what I read. For instance, I read National Geographic. I kind of like National Geographic, and I like the stories. I like the history. I like the geography in one thing and another. Now, in the old National Geographics, you know, going back to 1900, and I don't have them all the way back to 1888, but I've got them back to 1920 and 1915 and 1909, and I pick up those old National Geographics out of my collection here, and I read them once in a while. You know, the other day I picked up a 1915 issue, and here we are involved in World War I, and there's articles in there about World War I and various battles that are going on, and it's history, and it's something that's, you know, was written right at the time. And now, I noticed that back in the old days, they didn't speak very much of evolution. When they would write an article, they took it as there was a creation and there was a God and so on. And then something changed, and it changed in the 1920s. Then it was a very subtle change in the National Geographic. They started introducing this concept of evolution. By the 1940s, evolution is established. They don't talk about God anymore. They don't talk about creation. And then from the 1950s on, it's just a diatribe on billions and billions of years ago. Every article starts today in a National Geographic with the belief, with the preconceived belief that evolution is a fact and that the creation account is a lie, or that it didn't occur. That's not scientific. The Bible is scientific. There is science in the Bible. For instance, the science of spectroscopic analysis is in the Bible 4,000 years ago in the book of Job. Why, we didn't know about spectroscopic analysis until the last 100 or 200 years. I don't know exactly when it came about, but it's been around, you know, for less than 200 years. The Bible talks about the atomic theory. Hell, we didn't know anything about atomic theory until 100 years ago or so. The Bible talks about a round earth. You know, in spite of what the Pope said, the Bible calls the earth round. I say that that's better science than religion. And until, you know, probably the round earth came up probably around Galileo's time, around the 15th century. You know, up until then, the pagan nations, you know, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, they thought that there was a guy by the name of Hercules or Atlas, or that there was a big turtle swimming around in the cosmic sea, and that the world, you know, was square or rectangular, and it was flat, and it was riding on the back of this turtle. Or it was held up by these pillars, or by Atlas or somebody. I mean, we had all kinds of ideas, beliefs, religion, you know, comes into play. But it's been only in the last 500 years or so that we have been able to scientifically look at. And then, you know, the Pope came to Galileo and said, hey, you better recant, because if you don't, we'll call you a heretic and we'll burn you at the stake. Galileo did. He walked out and he said, well, after he confessed that the world was flat and not circling the sun, but the sun was circling the earth. I forgot what the argument was over now, but it didn't have anything to do with science. The church prevails because the church, as Mao Zedong once made an observation, he says, political power comes out of the muzzle of a gun. And the popes weren't ignorant to that. They understood how political power works. And they said, hey, listen, this is the official party doctrine. We've got that today. The official history of 9/11 is something different than the truth. The official history of World War II is something different than the truth. The official history is written by the winners. The winners write the history. And there's an official dogma, like the sinking of the Maine. You all know that it was the Spanish that snuck into Havana Harbor, tied something onto a torpedo or a mine or something onto the battleship Maine and blew it up. That's the official story. It's a lie. That isn't what happened at all, but then that's another story for another day. Meteorology is another science that comes from the Bible. I read that every once in a while to you, that Solomon made an observation clear back in 1000 BC or 900 BC. He said all of the rivers run into the ocean, but the ocean isn't full. That's a scientific statement. The Bible is full of science. Science that's been there for 4,000 years that has now been proven to be true, accurate, and correct. I've never heard an evolutionist say, wow, that's really interesting. How did the Apostle Paul know about the atomic theory 2,000 years ago? Maybe there's something to this. You know, if your brain isn't dead, you ought to be asking, you mean to tell me the atomic theory, meteorology, and spectroscopic analysis is contained in the Bible? Yeah, it is. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I could show you 50 scientific principles revealed in the Bible. 50. Maybe 100. But I'm pretty sure I can get to 50. And that's because Job was asked 40 questions. 4,000 years ago, when Job was asked these scientific questions by God himself, recorded in Job 38, Job could answer 3 questions out of 40. Job couldn't answer any of the 40 questions. As recently as 1936, we can now, today, answer 3 out of 40. That's how much scientific progress we've seen over the last 40 years. or the last 4,000 years. 4,000 years. We could answer three, Job couldn't answer any. Now, the Bible's full of science. And I hear religionists say, well, the Bible isn't a science book. And I'd beg to differ with that. The Bible is a science book. It's full of science. And the difference is, the science revealed in the scriptures 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago is now provable in the laboratory. You can take that to the Lawrence Radiation Lab in Livermore, California, and document it today. But you can't do that with evolution. Not anything in evolution can be taken into a laboratory and proven. Nothing. Zero. Zilch. If you've got one proof, send me an email, would you? Let me put it on the air. Let me say, my God, here's one proof of evolution. Now, you've got a lot of theories and ideas and hopes, and as one evolutionist put it, he said, the reason that we believe in evolution is because the alternative is unthinkable. Well, the unthinkable is there is a God. And that is kind of unthinkable, because if that's true, and there is a God out there, there might be some consequences for our behavior. And that is, I agree, absolutely unthinkable that we might be held to account for our conduct. Yeah, I got to give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 separate schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling The Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. Now, we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners, and these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or the publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited here on The Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed, or at least not wholly endorsed, by The Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, incident to that disclaimer there, this book that I'm reviewing here, heck of a good book, and it's put out by the Watchtower people, that's the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the title of the book is called Life, How Did It Get Here by Evolution or by Creation. The thing that really caught my attention here was that these guys have published or printed 18 million. That's 18 million copies of this book. And that was up through 1985. I mean, this book that I've got in my hands right here is copyrighted 1985. My God, that's, 20 years ago or more. I'm presuming that they might have put out a second, third, or fourth printing, and there might be more of these books out there than 20 million copies. I mean, you know, if you print a million copies of a book, that's called a bestseller. I mean, this thing is so far beyond bestseller. Now, of course, they might give these away. You know, Watchtower is Jehovah's Witnesses. Those are the good folks that come out, knock on your door, and pester you to death. And that's why I tell you that, you know, just because I recommend somebody's book or something, it doesn't necessarily mean that I endorse their religion or their politics or their science or anything else. I'm recommending this book because it's true, it's accurate, it's factual. I checked it out. They've got good footnotes in here. And it's written simply. I mean, a child can read this. Plumbers, carpenters, longshoremen, truck drivers. You know, if you're a truck driver and you're having a hard time reading and understanding evolution or the conflict between evolution and creation, this is the kind of book that you're looking for. Because it's written, you know, without all of those five-syllable, double-jointed knee action words, you know, that nobody understands, nobody knows what they'll eat. You know, once in a while you have to read, you have to take a dictionary in order to read a book. You know, you'll read a sentence and there's three words in there. You got to look them up in the dictionary to understand it. This book is written so that, if you're 10 years old, I think you can understand it. But it's not a child's book. It's written on an adult level, and it's written evidently by some very knowledgeable creation scientists. Now, one other story here that I wanted to pass on to you was we're talking about these intermediate species. There's a story in here about woodpeckers. And this woodpecker story over here is just one story. I could tell you 100 or 1,000 stories like this, but I want to tell you this woodpecker story because I think that when God created woodpeckers, he did so that he could give you the finger, you evolutionists. He's given you the finger with this woodpecker. I think the duck-billed platypus is another finger giver, but this one here, this woodpecker, I think is kind of the champion. Listen to this. A woodpecker has a special shock absorber cartilage between his skull and his neck bone, the last vertebrae in his neck. And that's because this woodpecker, when he pecks, he actually drives that beak into the wood with sufficient force to chip it. A woodpecker is like a jackhammer. And there's another little thing here, that the woodpecker, every time he pecks on the tree, he pecks on the tree with sufficient force and velocity that his eyeballs would pop right out of his head if he didn't close his eyes with each peck. Now, the reason we know this is because we can photograph a woodpecker with a slow motion camera. And we can slow down. We can take a lot more frames of the activity, then we can slow it down so that we can actually see what's happening. Because when you're listening to a woodpecker out in the forest pecking, it sounds like a machine gun. It goes brrrr, brrrr, and then each one of those brrrts there are individual pecks, which are so close together and so fast that in about 1 or 2 seconds, you have heard that brrrt, which is about 30 or 40 pecks in about 2 seconds. Now, here's something that's really phenomenal. Every one of those pecks is interspersed with the woodpecker opening his eyes and closing his eyes one time each peck. And there can be up to 40 pecks in 2 seconds. Hey, did you get that? Now, I didn't make that up. That sounds so preposterous that I couldn't make up a story like that. I had to read that. I had to look here in the literature. Now that's the woodpecker That's just the start of it. This woodpecker over here has this special cartilage because if he didn't have that special cartilage between his head and his neck, he'd kill himself pecking on that wood. With the kind of force that he applies to the wood, which literally chips the wood, reduces it to splinters as he bores a hole into the tree. Now, if you've ever taken a look at a hole in a tree that a woodpecker has pecked out, I mean, that's quite a little chore. That's quite a feat. All right, now that's the start of it. Now, this woodpecker, in order for him to work on the side of a tree at a 90-degree angle to his bill, he has special feet, special toes. There's two toes forward and two toes backwards. And this woodpecker can work upside down, sideways, right side up. He can work on the bottom of a limb. He can work on the top of a limb. He can work on the side of a tree. He can work upside down. It doesn't make any difference to the woodpecker. When he's working on the side of a tree with a 90-degree angle to the work surface, he has a special tail. His tail feathers are feathers, but they're special tail feathers which act as a prop. So he sticks those down against the trunk of the tree, buries his feet into the bark of the tree so that he's sitting here and he's stable as he's pecking this hole. Now, this woodpecker can drill a hole in a tree in about 15 minutes. I mean, he can drill that hole in the tree. He can drill a hole into a tree 3 inches deep in 15 minutes through solid wood. And the sapwood on the outside is solid. What he's after is the punk wood on the inside where the termites are located. Now, let's think about this in evolutionary terms, because before the woodpecker evolved, there was a bird before the woodpecker. Now, we don't have any intermediate species between the bird that was the bird before the woodpecker and the woodpecker today. Not a single intermediate species. You go back in the fossil record and you've got woodpeckers. All of those woodpeckers way back in the olden days, a million years ago, had two toes forward, two toes back, and the special feathers to jack him up and hold him onto the side of the tree. We don't know if he had the same abilities that we have today. We don't have any eyewitness observers. We don't have any slow motion film, you know, to see whether the old woodpeckers a million years ago could close their eyes and open their eyes 40 times a second or 2 or 3 seconds. I don't know that, and I don't know that any evolutionist does or doesn't know that, or creationist or anybody else, but we do know what we see today, and the physical anatomy of the bird today is the same as it was a million years ago, or what they claim is a million years ago, although the Bible says it was about 5,000 years ago, or 6,000 years. The flood occurred about 4,000 years ago, 4,300 years. Alright, so now we've got this bird with the special cartilage, with the special tail, and with the special toes. And this bird has special hearing, this woodpecker does. This woodpecker can hear the insects inside the tree. And the reason they know that, according to the literature here, you know, the people, the ornithologists, you know, they go out and study this, they've been watching these birds. A woodpecker runs up, he jumps onto a tree, he turns his head sideways, like, you know, he's listening, like a doctor with a stethoscope. He goes around the tree, he goes top to bottom, and then he leaves that tree, and he goes to another tree. He doesn't even waste his time pecking on the tree. So if you thought that woodpeckers were pecking holes into trees to see if there was something in there, no, that's not what they're doing at all. The woodpecker does not peck on the side of the tree one time until he knows there's something in there. Now, how does he know there's something in there? Because he can hear those insects crawling around inside that tree. That's how keen his hearing is. Other birds don't have that kind of keen hearing. Now, why did this woodpecker develop that kind of keen hearing, two toes forward, two toes backward, and the special tail feathers to hold him on the side of the tree, unless he needed that equipment? Now, this woodpecker needs all of that equipment. He needs more than that. Because the woodpecker, he has a tongue. Well, for that matter, sparrows have tongues also. But the woodpecker tongue is kind of special. You see, the woodpecker tongue starts in the back of his throat, just like your tongue and my tongue and the sparrow's tongue. But this woodpecker tongue goes up from the back of his throat, up through a special canal or channel, up over the top of his head, wraps around his brain, up over the top of his head, down his frontal lobe to his beak. Remember, it starts in the back of his beak, in the back of his throat. But it doesn't go straight out, you know, through the front of his beak. It goes up over the back of his head, over his brain, down the front, between his eyes, out through his nostril, back through his beak, and it extends out 10 inches beyond the front of his beak. It goes down the channel, that is the gallery, they call them, where the termites are working, goes down the gallery 10 inches into this gallery, into this hole, this tunnel in the wood, so that he can grab a hold of these termites. Now, other birds don't have that. Now, before the woodpecker evolved into the woodpecker, he didn't have that long a tongue. He had to have evolved that tongue, and he had to have a need to evolve that tongue. He had the need to evolve the tongue so that his 10-inch extra long tongue could go down into that gallery. Sparrows do not get their food that way. Sparrows also eat insects, but they wait until the insect comes out of the tree, and then they catch him and they eat him. There's all kinds of carnivorous birds out there, but they don't have tongues that reach 10 inches beyond the end of their beak. And so this woodpecker now is specially designed for this. And I'm going to use the word design, just like I use the word, you know, a tomato that has fish genes in it is specially designed by an intelligence for a purpose. I mean, we're not just breeding flounder genes into tomatoes for no good purpose. We're doing that so that they're frost resistant. I mean, you know, there's a reason behind it. There's a purpose. So when we look at this woodpecker today, I'm looking at it from the perspective of, well, whoever designed this woodpecker over here designed him to eat grubs and termites out of trees that were infected by these termites. And that this woodpecker is going to come over here and eat these termites. To do that, he has to have this 10-inch long tongue. Now, there's a problem that this termite faces, because if he sticks his tongue down the gallery and he touches this termite, the termite stops and he backs up. So the woodpecker has evolved barbs on the end of his tongue, just like the barb on a fish hook, so that when the tongue goes over or touches the termite, the bird puts the barbs out and stabs the termite and then hauls him up into his mouth. Now, isn't that just kind of fortuitous? Because if he didn't have the barbs on there, he couldn't catch the termite in the tunnel. Isn't that just kind of real neat? Now, he now has the termite on the barb. Now, there are some bugs that are in these holes here where the barb won't work. The barb doesn't work. So the woodpecker has evolved a special glue that comes out of a hollow tongue. See, this tongue is hollow. Yep. This is the only bird that has a hollow tongue. It has to have a hollow tongue so that there's a place for the glue to come out, kind of like a poison snake. It has to have a hollow fang so that the poison can come out through that fang. Well, this woodpecker has this hollow tongue, and there's glue comes out. The glue gets on for the end of the tongue and onto the grub inside the gallery. And that's because the barb won't go into this hard insect shell like it does the termites. Termite's soft, and so he stabs the termite. But when he's after a grub over here with a solid, hard shell... See, insects have their skeleton on the outside of their body.
And to penetrate that, or to get that grub, that bug, that insect, he has to have this glue on there. So, now with this glue on here, this is really an instant, fast, super glue. It hits on the bug. He shoots it with the glue. It instantly dries. He sucks his tongue back up into his beak with the bug on it. Now, this glue is so powerful. I mean, it's really powerful stuff, you know. And so, because of that, he has to have a solvent that will dissolve the glue. And he has this solvent in his saliva so that when this glue gets into his mouth, it doesn't stick the roof of his mouth, you know, like some peanut butters do, you know, to your tongue, and then strangle you to death. And so here's the instant dissolver that comes along. The instant solver dissolves the glue. The bird swallows the insect, sticks his tongue down, and pulls out another one. And he glues it on, sucks it in, dissolves it, swallows it. And this goes on back and forth in and out of this gallery as he's sucking these insects out of there. Now, my question is, this bird, before he had this kind of specialized equipment, had to be eaten every day, eating something, getting along just fine. Now, if you take a look at, let's take a martin, for instance. Now, he's an insect-eating bird, or a swallow. They eat insects. The swallow flies around in the air, and he catches insects. Bats fly around in the air, and they catch the insects flying around in the air. But bats and martins do not get the grubs and the insects out of trees. That's the woodpecker's job. Now, the woodpecker had to have been some other kind of bird before he evolved into the woodpecker. Now, if he was some other kind of bird before he evolved into the woodpecker, then why did he need to evolve into a woodpecker? If he was flying around in the air getting his food, then he didn't have any need. But if there weren't any insects in the air, and this is where evolution comes in, well, he had to have a need because he was starving to death. And so he had to develop a keen sense of hearing so that he could hear the insects inside the tree. But he didn't need the keen sense of hearing, and no other bird has that kind of hearing because they get their insects or they get their livelihood from some other source. See where I'm going with this? In other words, he had to have a need for the special hearing, the special tongue, the special claws on his feet, the special feathers on his tail. And he had to have a need for this extra 10 inches of tongue, and he had to have a place to store it. I mean, you know, just picture yourself. I mean, you know, you've got a tongue that fits comfortably in your mouth. Now, if you're starving to death and you need to evolve a 10-inch longer tongue, you need to have some evolutionary process that will store that extra 10 inches of tongue someplace in your head. And so you, too, are going to have to develop an evolutionary process whereby your tongue can attach to the back of your throat but goes up over the back of your head, down across the front of your forehead, out your nose, one nostril, through your beak, so that you have a place to aim it. And this tongue has to come out the end of the beak so that this bird has a place to aim it. But why would he evolve all of this elaborate, special paraphernalia to do what a woodpecker does so well until he had a need? But if he had a need, and we presume it's because he was starving to death, he would have starved to death over those millions of years while he was evolving this special apparatus, wouldn't he? For instance, as the woodpecker is starting to evolve into a woodpecker, he's not a woodpecker yet, but he's evolving, he goes up to the tree. And he can't hang on to the side of the tree because he hasn't got the special equipment, so he has to land on a limb and be pecking into the limb. He has to have the special shock absorber because if he doesn't have the shock absorber, when he pecks onto the tree, he's going to knock his eyeballs out. I mean, the woodpecker has to hit that wood with enough velocity to splinter it And when he does that, he's got to have a beak that is hard enough to withstand that kind of abuse. Ordinary birds don't. So the first bird went up there, he started pecking on the limb, and he broke his beak. After he broke his beak, he couldn't eat, so he died. Well, he died before he evolved the special beak that he needed to splinter the wood, before he evolved the special tongue that he needed to get the insects out of the hole. Because after he had evolved the special beak, and now he can drill the holes, he hasn't got a tongue that will go down into the hole to get the grub out. Now, here's the bottom line. A woodpecker is a specially designed creature that does his job perfectly well, the first time, every time. When a woodpecker is born, he doesn't know very much. But by the time that woodpecker is able to leave the nest and go out into the forest, he's just as equipped to drill holes into trees and get grubs out of there as his mother and father were, as his grandma and granddaddy, and his great-granddaddy and great-grandmama. And it goes on back for as far back in the fossil record as we can go, and there are no intermediate species between birds and woodpeckers. Now, you got a hollow tongue, you got glue on the tongue, you got solvent on the tongue, you got toes on the feet, you got feathers on the tail, you got his tongue going over his head, you have a long tongue that's 10 inches long, you've got a shock absorber cartilage over here, you've got special hearing. All of this has to work together, and he has to have all 10 of those things, and if he's missing any one of those 10, he cannot get insects out of that tree. And if he doesn't get insects out of the tree, then he starves to death. And if he isn't starving to death, then he doesn't need to evolve these 10 special characteristics that only woodpeckers have, and this one particular woodpecker that I'm telling you about. That's why I'm telling you that if you believe in Santa Claus coming down the chimney through a 6-inch pipe into a raging oil stove to deliver presents to little kiddies on December 25th, there is more reason, logic, and common sense and science behind that belief than there is evolution. Or there certainly isn't much less. Now that's the greatest con ever perpetrated. And the thing that's really so amazing is that you know that as well as I do. I haven't told you anything in this program that you didn't already know. Just a few details that you might not have heard of before. But I mean, you know, your common sense works just like mine. You knew that. Now you know why. You knew it, but now you know why. I'm about out of time here, children. We're going to have to leave it right there. And let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. That's the place to start. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.